You're listening to WCOM LP Chapel Hill and Carrboro 103.5 FM on your radio dial. Freedom of expression is essential to a free society, and that's what we are here at Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theater.
Indeed.
Your host Claudio, Renaissance man and bard of WCOM, has opened the doors of the speakeasy to invite you all in to find a seat. Get comfortable in the place where you're always welcome and can always expect the very best.
We good absolutely morning. Hope so. Good morning. Good morning. We have the pleasure of a good friend of mine who's shown up again. David Henderson is here in the studio with us this morning.
Good morning.
Want to give a quick shout out, as I usually do, to the Historic Carolina Theater of Durham. They've got all kinds of stuff coming up, so please check out their website. I think the things that are coming up there are a little too numerous for me to mention in one quick scoop here, but please check them out if you appreciate them as our sponsor. Give them your support, the Carolina Theater of Durham. And, of course, in the studio here with me is Audrey Layden, who also has Carrboro Bookbeat. And I'm basically going to get into David Henderson's life and catch up with all things in the theater world. He does a lot of work with Ira David Wood and does a lot of directing of productions that he likes. As a matter of fact, instead of me pulling all kinds of titles out of the wind, I'm going to let you do it because you know how they fell into place. So, whoops!
All right,
so
good morning.
I'll behave myself. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome
here,
aboard.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've seen you. So
more than a year.
Yeah, right at it. And since then, thankfully, I've been fortunate to stay fairly busy in the theater, and I have directed a couple of shows. I directed Twelfth Night for the town of Cary. They inaugurated an annual outdoor Shakespeare at Cocoa Booth Amphitheater out there, and we performed in August, which is, you know, hot, but we managed to do it. And we performed for over 1,000 a night, and that was a nice start.
I remember you telling me about it.
For the presentation. And I also directed the complete works of Shakespeare Abridged, which I believe you got a chance to see. And as an actor, I did Doubt by John Patrick Shanley at Theater in the Park. And then that's about it. I think that's kept me fairly busy. Right now, obviously, I'm in the throes of A Christmas Carol. We just finished our run at the DPAC last weekend, and that was a wonderful, wonderful experience. And we open tomorrow night.
No doubt, you said that Ira David Wood actually showed up, so he's progressed quite well from the heart surgery.
He has progressed very, very well. He's looking great, feeling great, and having him around for the show really was a boost in the arm to the cast and
wonderful.
The crew, that's for sure.
Well, at some point, we're definitely going to have him back on the speakeasy again.
Good.
To catch up about all that.
Good.
I knew he was going in for something medical, but he has an interesting way of keeping things to himself. I had no idea it was that serious.
Yeah. Yeah, he. I remember when he called to tell me, it was not an easy conversation to hear or for him to have, and he did obviously, and he'll tell you this, he did the right thing to go and get it taken care of immediately, but and we love him, we support him, and
absolutely,
and we are still wishing him the best. But like I said, he is making an amazing recovery, and that's
well on that note to bring up another rather scary subject, and his son Ira the what is it, the fourth.
Yeah,
let me get these numbers right. To jump in as Scrooge. Literally jumping into what, a 30 some year tradition?
Yep, 35 years. This is our 36th year. So, yeah, Ira was originally slated to play the lamplighter in the production this year.
Mm-hmm.
And when his father had to have the surgery, he moved over to take over the role of
Scrooge. How's this for lighting a lamp, pal?
Yeah, exactly. A little fire under him. And it's been wonderful to see the cast rally around Ira, to see the cast really support him in the journey he has to take, considering that while he's doing and taking on the burden of doing this role, he's also having to, you know, deal with the fact that his father is having open heart surgery.
Yeah,
so it was a very, very interesting time. And,
Rachel Wood here as well, or is she still?
Evan is still here. Okay. She was here to help direct while Ira was doing Scrooge, and she's been around throughout the whole process.
Big hello to Evan. I remember her well.
Yeah, it's good to have the whole family around, and I think that really helps David, obviously, in the recovery to have his kids with him.
Oh, no doubt. Yeah.
And Ira has really, 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 really stepped up to the plate, and he put on some performances in Durham this weekend that anyone would be proud of.
Wow. Yeah. That's great news to hear.
Yeah, it's very
good. I'm really glad he's doing well. As soon as he's up to it, we'll yank him out. I want to do at some point the complete history of A Christmas Carol. I think it's something worth archiving as a North Carolina product.
Yeah, interesting. I had this conversation with someone the other night about that exact subject. I would be interested to find other theatrical productions that have run as long as A Christmas Carol, specifically Christmas or holiday shows. And I think you'd be hard-pressed to
Nothing
find
to rival it, in my opinion.
No, and the technical director, Tim Ruffin, who is a dear friend of mine, was telling me the other night that he remembers when they first moved to Memorial Auditorium to do Christmas Carol, he took the props and stuff to the theater in a station wagon.
now it's literally Broadway.
We have three tractor trailers that carry our sets, our props, and our costumes. Yeah, it's a massive show.
It is. And to me, it's as good as anything on Broadway.
I like to think that as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a heart to it that is really... keeps me coming back, I can tell you that. Ironically, I say
hard. Well, he's, of course, stuck in the role as...
Jacob Marley.
There we go.
I've played Marley for 14 years. I've done the show for 17.
I don't think we could miss Marley.
So. No, well, it's my Christmas gift to myself.
Yeah, I fully understand that.
And having done it with David for so long, I love David. David is like my brother, mm-hmm. and being on stage with him is a real gift. And I trust him. He trusts me. We know what the other's going to do before the other does
it. It's wonderful
to
have that rapport.
And we know that anything we can get out of. And it's nice now. The interesting thing I told David the other night, I did prefer when the almost 20-year age difference between Scrooge and Marley was the other way.
the one thing he keeps touting every time he comes on the radio show, he says, you know, Claudio, I used to have to put on makeup to play Scrooge.
Yeah.
This is the older I get, the less that's necessary.
and Ira, it just turned 26 years old. So again, that to taking over this massive role to be as young as he is. And again, he's doing great. And he and I are finding a rhythm that becomes our own. So it's unique. It's very rare as an actor you get to do something again for the first time.
Yes.
And that's what's happening this
so
year.
So is he and I don't want to give anything away from the show, but is he maintaining a similar posture as far as character goes with Scrooge to Ira David Wood III, or is he taking a little bit of a different slant?
I will say you will not be disappointed.
diplomatic of you.
No, I think he is... I said this in an article the other day in the News Observer. I think it's beautiful to watch him create his own Scrooge while really paying homage to his father.
Good.
So there are very, very familiar things.
Do we still have the political satire?
You
definitely
do.
I can't see the show missing that.
It has quite a bit. And, you know, you never know what names will pop up here and there in the show.
Right.
And the audience has really embraced him as well. The cast is really there for him. But it's nice to hear the audiences embrace him, too. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't be more proud of him.
Well, he's made himself quite visible with some of the productions that he directed as well as performed in a Theater in the Park. So.
Correct, yeah. He had done Romeo and Juliet just over a year ago.
For which Evan Rachel Wood came down.
Evan came in, and I played Friar Lawrence in that production. Yes. And I've known Evan and Ira since they were little teeny babes in arms. And,
Before I knew you, though.
It's wild to see them grow and become such wonderful, wonderful people and to be there for their dad during this period of time. And David's wife, Ashley, I can't say enough about her. She is a wonderful woman. And really having her around, too, helps me. You know, she's always smiling and always positive. So it's been a really great experience under what could have been very difficult circumstances.
No doubt.
Yeah.
No doubt. So the run is complete at DPAC now, and we're starting at Memorial.
We ran Friday, Saturday, Sunday in Durham, which was wonderful. The DPAC, if you haven't been, go. It's a great space. The people there are wonderful. It's the second time we did the show there. We opened the DPAC in 2008.
Do you remember that?
B.B. King was technically the first performance. We were the first show there. And
of course, he also emceed the actual opening, Ira David Wood.
Yes, he did. And now we move to Raleigh. Tomorrow night we open and run for a week. We do 9 shows in 7 days, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, two Saturday,
You're
one Sunday.
You're going to be busy, boy.
Yeah, I'm going to be tired, too, because the older I get, the harder it is to bounce around on these knees.
Yes, and it's not a short show.
No, it is now a 55-minute first act, hour, 15-minute second act. So
you've trimmed it.
We've trimmed it, David.
My goodness.
Several years ago, David made some changes to the show, and it's really it really hits at it.
Because I remember the day that it was close to 3 hours.
Oh, I was in it when it was at 1:310 or something like that. And right now the first act runs around 55 minutes and the second act is about an hour 15.
Yeah. Which is still a wonderful time. And the beauty of it was, even when it was close to 3 hours, it never lost you.
No, that's the one thing about the show I think that's really important for people to realize is, with all the political satire, with all of that, the essence and the heart of the story is still there. Mm-hmm. It is about a transformation. Scrooge,
absolutely.
You know, from miserly old skinflint to embracer of humanity. Mm-hmm. And that journey is there. He doesn't stray very far from the actual story. Granted, we throw in Mel Gibson here or there. Yes. But the...
Yeah, right, okay.
That was
knife on it.
I did that this weekend to Ira. But we do that. But the audience needs, I think, those kind of releases, because it is to watch that journey. You know, families come together to see the show. We look out and we see fathers holding their kids closer. We look at people holding hands during the show, during the moments of the show. And I think sometimes you need to laugh in order to get to that ending moment where you see Scrooge change and you mm-hmm. see, you know, the audience in tears. One of the most beautiful moments in the show, to me, has always been the lullaby that Bob Cratchit sings to Tim.
Yes.
And it's I, David, now Ira, John Scherer, and Frankie Terrio. We're all sitting back on Scrooge's bed, kind of in the dark, watching this happen and listening to Bob Cratchit sing this song to his son, who may not make it another year. Is a wonderful, beautiful moment, and you can hear pins drop in the audience.
I can imagine,
and it's a great moment, and it changed drastically for me when I became a father. And David had told me that it would change.
Oh,
when
I'm
I became
sure
a
he
father.
Did. Yeah,
and you know, me going, oh, really?
Yeah, come on.
I'm an actor; it won't change. Oh boy, did it! The first time I heard that sung in performance or in rehearsal. I almost couldn't go on. It's a beautiful moment, and I love that moment, because we can kind of look out peripherally and see the audiences, and we can see mm-hmm. the fathers with their children and the mothers
them.
And their husbands. It's a beautiful, beautiful moment. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, having been in that audience, I can attest to
it.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, years ago, I was very open to taking on a continuing part in it myself, but for some reason my life has had me in too many directions to have made it every year.
Yeah, it's you know, it's been going for, this is the 36th year.
That's
and I
amazing.
Think there's a huge it's a huge credit to the theater. I mean, Brent Simpson, who is the marketing person, and Aaron West and Thomas Porter, everybody in the theater really pulls together to put this show on. The board of directors, it's a real family, if you will, mm-hmm. Event, and it went from a station wagon to three tractor trailers, yeah. You know, and there's something to be said for that. And
oh,
it,
no doubt about that.
Bringing that spirit of the season to, you know, 2,000 people a night is a real gift.
In many respects, the actual production, the teamwork, the artistry behind putting this ambitious spectacle mm-hmm. together, it's reflective of the work itself.
Yes.
The way it emerged and where it stands now.
And you know, one of the things, the nice things about Ira being able to assume the role for his father is David is undergoing, you know, a transformation of the heart himself.
Oh, no doubt.
Quite literally. And to see that that transformation in his son mm-hmm. from, you know, 26-year-old, I'm going to play the lamplighter, to now I'm taking on the lead role in this three-tractor trailer production. It's a beautiful thing to watch and a beautiful thing to be a part of.
No doubt.
Not saying it's not scary sometimes, but it's a beautiful, beautiful thing to be a part of. I can tell you that.
So give us the remaining dates.
We run Wednesday, open this Wednesday, which what's today? The 7th.
The 7th,
The 8th. We run the 8th through the 15th in Memorial Auditorium. We have two shows on Saturday, one matinee on Sunday. We have Sunday night off so we can all recover and they can dry my costumes. And
will Ira be doing his traditional Truman Capote?
He will not this year.
I was wondering.
A Christmas Memory is not happening this year. But he will be back next year, I believe, for Christmas Carol. So we're all looking forward to that.
I would think so.
Yeah. And he's going to direct. I think he's directing a show he wrote at Theater in the Park called Devon Does Denmark. That's
called what again?
Devon Does Denmark.
Devon Does, okay.
It's a wonderful comedy.
Okay.
And then the final show of the season he's slated to direct, which is Noises Off.
All right. He's had that on before, but I don't know if he directed
it. It's
or was
a
just
great, great show.
Yeah.
And, you know, if anybody who's been in theater will love it. So.
Yeah, well, anybody who's been in theater should know that joke.
Yeah, trust me. That's true. Probably has done it. So.
Yeah, no doubt. So let's bounce around a little bit into your personal life. But before we go there, I want to make a quick mention that Audrey Layden, Alan Hall, and myself, our Christmas gift this year is going to be, we're going to do a Reader's Theatre version here on the Speakeasy of Khalil Gibran's The Prophet.
That's going to be coming up on the 21st on the Speakeasy. 21st from 10 to 11 on Tuesday. So I just thought, since we're talking all things Christmas, we might as well plug that for
That's
the time
true.
Being.
Go for it.
And now we'll plug
season.
You. Go ahead.
Oh, no.
I mean, basically, what are some of the big changes in your life that have happened since I've seen you? Like, last time I saw you, you were still on with me on the old station.
Correct. That is correct.
So it has been quite some time.
You guys have moved up in the world. I probably stayed laterally. No. you know, I've been very blessed as an artist. Excuse me. As an artist, I've been very blessed to have the opportunities that I have living here. You know, I'm fortunate enough to be able to work with David and mm-hmm. Theater in the Park. I also do a lot of work with the Justice Theater Project.
Right, which is one I'm very interested in.
Yeah, very, very, very good stuff going on there. And I'm actually going to do a show with them in February. It's the stage adaptation of Tuesdays with Maury. Which should be a really
let me know about
experience.
That, and I'll also announce it here on radio. But I want to come see it.
Definitely will. And then I come into your neighborhood in the April May timeframe and do Othello with Deep Dish Theater. So a lot of right now is in preparation for those things. Being a dad is a big deal. So
it's got to be.
And as you know, in the year that since I've seen you, really. My son has gone from 2 to 3, which apparently is a huge transition. And all of a sudden, he's talking and reasoning with me in ways that I never thought he would be able to do. And and that keeps me very busy. So, the big thing this summer was doing the 12th night. The 12th night experience was wonderful. We didn't know what the response would be. We auditioned. We had a cast of about 18 to 19 people.
At the amphitheater, right?
Yep, at Coca Booth. And Coca Booth is a beautiful space.
I have to go look at it.
It's gorgeous. It's really the summer home of the symphony, and they do a lot out there.
Okay.
And it's right on the lake. Yeah, it's right on the lake in Cary.
Yes.
It seats, they can get 7,000 people in there.
Well, that's expanded because it was not that big when I was
there. Yeah, it's huge.
Wow.
And we didn't know what we were going to have. We rehearsed for a month. And opened, and the first night we had, I think it was 600 people, and then we went to 900, and then we closed with over 1,000. We only did 3 shows, but it grew, and I think the town was very happy. I was very happy from an artistic standpoint, and I got to do the show with a bunch of people that I care about, and mm-hmm. that's a big thing for me is the blessing that I have is to do what I love with people that I love.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, and
there's nothing worse when you're on stage and having somebody on stage with you that you're not sure you can trust.
Right.
That throws everything off.
Yeah, there's a true feeling of ensemble, and a lot of theater really succeeds because of that ensemble feeling. I mean, look at Steppenwolf in Chicago. That's a prime example. Of the Labyrinth Theater, excuse me, Philip Seymour Hoffman's theater in New York. There's this sense of ensemble that I think really helps the work that the audience sees be stronger.
Oh, no doubt, yeah. Absolutely. So that was a bit of a breaking point for you, or a breakthrough for you in some ways?
Yeah, I think so. In a lot of ways, I learned a great deal about myself as a director. During that performance and that process, I love Shakespeare. That was my mm-hmm. undergraduate degrees was in English with a focus on Shakespearean literature. So it was nice to kind of come to that. And it's funny, when we first started, I tried to talk him out of doing Twelfth Night. I said, "Oh God, come on! It's not a comedy." And it really isn't. But it's let me rephrase that. It is, but it's a mature comedy. Mm-hmm. And by the end of the process, I have fallen so in love with that piece that I didn't want it to end. So that was a real big growing experience for me. And it kind of re-energized me, considering I'm going to do Othello later, to kind of go back and relook at Shakespeare in a different way, in a more mature way. I think Olivier always said that your first Lear is just practice for your second Lear, and I think that's true with Shakespeare. As you age, it continues to give you more and more.
And the meaning comes through more as well.
Yes. I mean, you know, there's a when I was a child, I thought as a child kind mm-hmm. of thing. And I think that's true with Shakespeare.
Absolutely.
It's when I was younger, I see the surface meanings of certain things. And as I get older, I start to see the resonance.
I think it tends to be true, I mean, definitely to Shakespeare, but it tends to be true with just great literature.
Exactly. Yeah, I think, you know, and that's what makes great literature, and I think that's what makes the things that survive mm-hmm. is the things that give you, continue to grow with you.
And all of a sudden you understand why they still live.
Yeah, and people always ask me about Shakespeare. I used to teach elementary school.
Willie the Shake.
Yeah, the Bard of Avon. I I told people when I taught kindergarten through fifth grade, and I would teach my third graders Shakespeare. And people go, how do you do that? I say, well, how do you not? I mean, they see it, you know? It's not like these are horrid stories that no one has heard of. They're the human experience, you know, love, jealousy, murder.
Absolutely.
You know, those kind of things. And they can understand those. And the beauty of irrational love is a great one to teach to high school students, you know, that whole kind of,
oh yeah,
you know, love at first sight thing. So
you're going to go through this.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Romeo and Juliet is I've done the show three times, and each time I find something different in it. I've played the same role three times, so each time there's something different that I bring to the role, or that the role brings to me, I should say.
You find the added dimensions, or they find you in
they typically going over find the me. You know, you're reading it, and all of a sudden you go, oh, that's what that means. God, I wish I'd have known that 10 years ago, you know? But when I first did Friar Lawrence, I was 26 years old. So here's this young priest, that's one thing. And then I did it, you know, in my 30s, so still kind of a young priest. And now, you know, doing it again as I'm, you know, closer to 40, there was something else. And I was a father at the time, so the relationship between he and Romeo changed. So there was a lot in there that really kind of started to go, oh,
a whole different sentiment, I would say.
Very much so.
Do you think there's something strange about insisting that Romeo and Juliet be included in the curriculum for high school students, when it's about two people who commit suicide? That really bothers me, because suicide is a very difficult problem with teenagers. And here you have people dying for love, and it's dramatized. I don't like that.
I can see your point.
That's a point to ponder, that's for sure.
I think one of the ways, it depends on how it's taught, I think, which is really essential. I think that the key, what leads them to that act is the question that I always have, is this animosity and this hatred. I hate you because your name is this. I have nothing else. It's years of hate, and it's known and taught behavior that I hate you because your name is Montague. You hate me because my name is Capulet. So I think that the teachers in the wrong hands,
I think you could
glorify, not glorify, but you know what I mean. I think that it becomes kind of a romanticized version of death for love. Where for me, it's now more about hatred and more about this unfounded kind of bigotry and racism, even, if you will. A real good friend of mine in L.A. works with a playwright called Kirkwood Bromley, and he does modern adaptations of Shakespeare. Now, they're all written in iambic pentameter, but they're versions of his plays. And the Romeo and Juliet is about, called Icarus and Aria, and it's about a football player. About being promoted to the NFL, and there are a lot more elements of race and challenges in there because of that kind of hatred, and it really resonates more, and it's very hard to watch, especially at the end.
Just to address your question, which I think is very relevant, because I've experienced a suicide myself in my own life very deeply, but I will state that Shakespeare in Romeo and Juliet makes a good point of, if it's well taught in the right hands, as you put it, of exposing the tragedy of that decision, the futility that brought the whole thing about, and then the irony when you realize how wasted it was.
And I think that's where it comes down to teaching. I remember when I first fell in love with Shakespeare, when Sharon Hearn, my English teacher, came in and put on an album of the BBC production of Julius Caesar, and I was just listening to it. And years later, I was reading, and they always talk about how in Elizabethan times, people went to hear a play. They didn't go to see it. They went to hear the play.
There's so much more going on in the imagination, for one thing.
And just listening to it, it really
resonates. Like radio.
Yes, exactly. We will not all kill ourselves at the end of this show, I hope.
We may kill each other and save ourselves the trouble.
But I think, to your point, I think that the teachers that can handle that type of material are going to help the students navigate. And I think a key to that, if you are doing it with youth, is to have ancillary things going on with the production where we discuss suicide and getting to that point. I do know of productions that have had a kind of, not a, I won't say a counselor, but they've had that kind of discussion, that dialogue with the show.
I'll give you one that actually helped me a lot. I saw this years before my mother's death, but it actually really helped me understand where she was coming from, and that was Night Mother.
Oh, yeah. No. Oh. That's not a light evening of theater.
This is Spacek, right? And I actually saw a friend of mine, Marty Barletta, and I forget the other actresses that were in it, were playing it at Theater in the Park.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I think there's a movie made with Anne Bancroft and Sissy Spacek.
Yeah.
And it will shock you, but it does truly, truly, having gone through a suicide experience in my own family history, it truly, truly, truly helps you understand it.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that Romeo and Juliet is included. I guess I think people want to include it because it has to deal with youth. Mm-hmm, you know, it's like, right. Oh, it's youth. I like, you know, you ask me about Shakespeare, and I want to learn. I want to hear the history plays. You know, Richard II, Richard Hamlet. III, Hamlet.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that was my introduction to Shakespeare when I was 12 years old, and it was Olivier in Hamlet, the old black and white movie. And the whole thing starts out, you know, on the ramparts of the castle, and you've got this spooky music in the background, you know, and Rosencrantz and Montague are walking around talking about, will it come tonight?
Yeah.
You know, and then the ghost comes, Hamlet's ghost, I mean, the ghost of the father. And I was just totally entranced.
Yeah, once it gets you, it gets you.
Yeah.
And my son actually has a Shakespeare action figure with removable quill.
Oh, no.
I'm not kidding. That is true.
That.
And he knows who Shakespeare is. Uh-huh. He sees him. He talks about it. And it's really important to me to introduce him to that, especially because of language.
The language is incredible.
There's a beauty in this heightened language that by necessity, I guess, and laziness to a certain degree, we've kind of gotten away from. Mm-hmm. There was a production of Romeo and Juliet recently that a friend of mine said he almost walked out of because Romeo and Juliet, it came to the party scene, and the first thing you see them do is they pull out their phones.
Oh, no.
And they start texting. And the words are broadcast, so you see, you know, you start seeing what they're saying, but then that disappeared and they moved in. He said, that's what saved it. He said, but it made it immediate because it's, you know, if I see Audrey across a crowded room and I think, hey, she's attractive, and I have her, and maybe I have her phone number, I send her a text to say, hey, lady, you know, and she looks at me. It made it real and immediate for the millennial generation that is seeing the show, but then they went right back into the words, and he said it was really a nice moment. He said it was a risk because, you know, at some point you're going, oh God, they're going to text this whole thing and I'm going to leave, but then they did it in such a way that it worked.
It pulled you in
and then they relied on that language.
Now let's slip onto another thing. Because I very much enjoyed you in Doubt. And what inspired you to take that part? I mean, I'm personally very fascinated by religion, the sort of religio-political aspects of church and state.
But, David had mentioned it to me a while back, and funny enough, I never saw the movie.
Neither did I. Your version was the only one I've seen so far.
I'd never seen the stage play. I read the script when it first came out, and it's a Pulitzer Prize winning play.
Right.
But at the end of it, I went, oh God, I didn't like it. And and I'll put like in quotes. I just went, and that dot, dot, dot.
Yeah.
And then we got into rehearsals and I loved it. I find that happens to me a lot.
Now, you directed that, didn't you?
No, I was just in it.
Oh, you're in it.
David directed it. Yep, he directed it. Our assistant director, Jesse Gephardt, is a great guy, too. He was a lot of help. And it really started to speak to me. We had a wonderful Catholic priest come in and talk to us for a long time one night about things. And then they kind of let me just do it. And I loved the play, the complexity of the play, and that the play is not about did he or didn't he. The play is about doubt. And that we had a talk back one night after the show moderated by David Crabtree. And as an actor,
oh, really? I didn't know that.
As an actor, it's always an odd feeling to sit on stage while people are talking about the play and you know, as if you're not there.
Yeah.
but, you know, they wanted to have a vote of who thought he did and who thought he didn't. And I'll tell you, only three people knew my choice as an actor, and that was David and Jesse. They were the only two I told my choice as an actor. And we did that, and the women knew I knew, and I think that it hopefully created some tension there because I knew the truth, as I should have, but they didn't. And I think that helped Linda and I.
Linda Clark gave you Linda, some wonderful support there.
Linda and I have a great time on stage together. We've done several. We did a Tom Stoppard piece several years ago called Night and Day, and we had a great time. And I think that Linda was really did some great work in Doubt, and the two of us together.
She did. She was
had a blast.
Perfectly
cast. We had a
it.
Blast. Had a blast.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the show.
Thank you
very
much.
I was just wondering what inspired you to go in that particular direction, because that, of course, that ties right in with the whole Catholic controversy of child abuse and so on.
Yeah, and it was very interesting to have a priest sit in and discuss the show with us. I mean, you never know when you start opening these doors. And I think the beauty of
the show. Let's tell our listeners a little bit, what is Doubt?
Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah,
Doubt. Indeed, we're assuming the public knows.
Yeah, Doubt is a play by John Patrick Shanley, and it centers around a Catholic school and a priest who is a younger priest, in my mind, because I like to fancy myself the younger priest. but he is very good with the children, and the Mother Superior of the Sister Aloysius starts to have feelings that he has singled out the first African American student at the school for special attention. And by
if I may interject, that there's also the spirit, at least, of a bit of a rivalry between her and you, more on her part than yours.
Correct. One of the things that plays into it is the gender politics of the time. It's set in the 60s. It's set in the year after Kennedy was assassinated, so it's 64.
And the setting is the church itself.
And she has these assumptions or these suspicions that he has had an inappropriate relationship with this young African-American child, and she's determined to prove it. So she enlists another young nun in trying to help her gather information on it. And the play plays out as a power grab. And ultimately, she is not going to let go. She brings the mother of the African-American child in for an amazing scene about that. Mm-hmm. And then ultimately, she gets the priest to request a transfer.
Hmm.
And at the end of the show, the last line of the show is her saying, "I have doubts. I have so much doubt." And she's so dogged in her determination that he is guilty.
The strength of the whole production to me was in the fact that nothing is provable.
Nothing's proved.
They never say the word sex abuse. They never say anything that would lead you to think otherwise. And the beauty for me is the opportunity to just to do a show like that, is to play this character that one character thinks is a complete villain, but to be able to try to do that in a way that draws an audience in and they go, "Wait a minute, there's no way," or "Total kid toucher," you know. I mean, that's the joy of doing that show, and it was a heck of a journey to take. I can tell you that much.
I'm sure, because in many respects, he's the priest to the audience that comes to see the show, because it starts out with him preaching.
Yeah, there's several sermons, and there's a great sermon in the show about gossip that he talks about, and how he compares gossip to taking a pillow up onto the roof, cutting it open, and letting the feathers fly away. And then trying to gather those all back up.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful, wonderful scene. I mean, John Patrick Shanley has written a very, 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 very good play. And, you know, it's been done a lot recently, and then it became a movie.
Have you seen that?
I still have not seen the movie.
Robert De Niro and Meryl Streep,
Philip Seymour Hoffman, Amy Adams, and Meryl Streep.
Okay, where'd I get De Niro from?
But he's
in everything.
Yeah, I wish.
Yeah,
but it's nice, and I assume that the movie was successful. I don't know, because like I say, I haven't seen it.
I'm not sure, to tell you the truth.
But it's a great piece of theater, because again, it gets audiences talking, and I think that's the key to great theater, is you're going to talk. Mm-hmm. You can hate it. You can love it. You can laugh. You can cry. But when you leave, you're going to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And that's what I want people to do. Mm-hmm. And that's, as artists, I think that's what everybody wants to do. Any play you go see, at the end of it, the audience should talk. I want to ride home Absolutely. With Audrey going, what did you think?
Uh-huh.
You know?
Right, yeah. Right.
Well, Alan Hall invited me to come and see it, and him and I were talking about it well before we went to see the show, and of course had great conversations about it afterwards.
Yeah, and Shanley had said that when he wrote it as without an intermission. We did take an intermission. But he wrote mm-hmm. it without an intermission, and he said that the second act of the play is what happens when the audience leaves the theater.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's right. I think that
yes.
at the end of it, he doesn't answer it. He doesn't look at you and say, Flynn is guilty, Flynn is innocent, he did or he didn't. He leaves it up to you to talk about and really get to the essence of doubt.
It's what almost, doubt? In a very real way, it's what good journalism should be, what good journalism should provoke,
mm-hmm.
instead of feeding you a bias.
Yeah. Give you discussion points.
Yeah,
yep,
exactly.
And it was a good experience as an actor, and I got to do it with people that
yes,
I care about.
Absolutely.
So,
yes, directed by someone you love.
Yes, 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 very much.
And then there is, of course, we go back to Shakespeare. I want to say the annotated Shakespeare, yeah.
the complete quite. Works of Shakespeare abridged, yes. which in and of itself is a funny title, by the Reduced Shakespeare Company. Yeah, Theater in the Park. We have done several of their shows. The first one was A Complete History of America Abridged.
That's right.
And this one, I went right out of Twelfth Night, took two of my actors from Twelfth Night and my stage manager from Twelfth Night, put them on stage, and they did all of the Bard's plays in 90 minutes, give or take. it's a wonderful, wonderful piece because you don't have to know about Shakespeare mm-hmm. to appreciate it. If you do know Shakespeare,
you get it
on a different level. But we used to joke and say it's about innuendo. It's about making the audience laugh. There's a lot of audience participation, and it was very, very successful.
Very slapstick too.
Yeah, mm-hmm. there's a lot of crazy stuff going on. Men in women's dresses and wigs and
yes.
vomiting and
fun.
Oh yeah,
fun.
It's great evening of theater. But we did. The audiences came to see it in droves, and we were really, really happy to have people laughing in there. Now, we did have a couple of people walk out. There was the the last day, this woman she got up in the 10 minutes in after I think Juliet had pretended to vomit on the audience, and she went, "This is disgusting."
Oh, no.
Made her way all the way across the stage yelling and telling us how bad it was as she left. But, when you run for 3 weeks and you've got 200 some people a night and you are really, walking a line sometimes.
And you tend to get giddy toward the final run anyway.
Well, but only one person to walk out, fine.
I remember something, not anybody walking out, but I think it was, I'm not sure if it was the Course Acting Comedy Show or what it was, but there was I want to say Jake Farrell was in one of the skits, but this skit might have been Tony Lee, I'm not sure, but there was a scene where a guy he cuts himself accidentally and he's literally bleeding out and trying to hide the fact that he's bleeding out. What is
that? Eric Carle.
Eric Carle, thank you very much.
Oh, yeah.
I went to see that show. It was hilarious and Eric was perfect in it. But he literally, he's got this little pump in his pocket and he's pumping blood all over the stage and just trying to hide the fact that, he's literally bleeding to death and carrying conversation with us. But it's totally abstract, but really well done.
Yeah.
There were two elderly ladies sitting in the front row that completely passed out.
Yeah.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah. I think anytime you introduce blood yes. into a show.
And the squirting, it was, it was plenty of blood.
Several years ago, it's been over 5 years ago now, my wife and I did a show with Raleigh Ensemble Players called Killer Joe.
Ah.
It took place in a trailer, and it was about hiring this family that hired a hitman to kill the wife.
So the stage was set as a trailer?
It was. We did it inside of a trailer. It was,
oh, wow.
The set design was awesome. We had a full, it was built really built off the blueprint of a trailer. We had the kitchen, the refrigerator and the stove, bedrooms and everything, and the entrance. But the show ends in a huge fight, like massive hand-to-hand combat, people getting stabbed with potato peelers, and then getting shot. And we all had squibs that we would use. And like one guy got beat to death with a table leg inside the refrigerator. There was a sponge loaded with blood, and the blood would shoot up onto people's faces. And then while we were down there, I was holding him down while a guy was beating him with a table leg. And I reach into the butter tray in the refrigerator. Now, this is why I love acting, is all of this is going on. The audience is going, oh, my God, they're killing a guy with a table leg. And all I got to go is, oh, is the squib in the butter tray? And I grab it, and I've got it in my hand, and I stand up just as the guy shoots me. And I slap the squib on my stomach, and it explodes. Blood shoots on the ceiling God. And everywhere. God. And after the show one night, this woman came up to me, and there was blood all over her playbill. And she goes, would you sign this?
Whoa.
I said, what? She goes,
perfect.
This is amazing. You know, and of course we had other reactions too,
yeah, no
to
doubt.
That. But it's a great, great thing when it's visceral for the audience,
oh,
you know.
Yeah.
And that's blood is always like that. We didn't have anybody walk out during that show.
And frankly, that scene with Eric Carle, going back to that,
yeah,
was amazingly effective. I mean, you know, you see him, his wrists squirting out like that, and then him covering it with something, and then putting it behind his back, and you can still see drip, not just dripping, but pouring while he's trying to hide it. And you totally psychologically you identify with this person.
It's interesting.
And I think these ladies just did too much of that because they went out cold.
When you talk about walking out, a friend of mine went to see Billy Elliot at the DPAC,
mm-hmm.
and apparently the night he was there, someone in the audience who had tickets didn't really know what the show was about. And when Billy's friend kisses him, and it's on the cheek, mind you,
right.
A boy kissing a boy on the cheek, this person got up loudly and left.
Well, he thought it was a gay show.
He did not like that.
Oh, Lord.
Did not like that being done on stage. Uh-huh. And I went, wow, people.
Yikes.
Really? Yeah. Come on. So it's interesting to see what kind of triggers people have. I mean, here we are beating a guy to death with a table leg and a sponge, and nobody walks
violence.
Out. But a young man kisses his friend on the cheek as a congratulatory gesture, and somebody gets up and screams and walks out. So it's a really interesting. That years ago, there was actor in the area named Mike Rourke, and Mike was a dear friend. He has since passed away and was a real loss. He ended up becoming an Episcopal priest later in life before he passed away. But he did a production of Burn This at Raleigh Little Theater.
Great. I saw Terrence Mann in that.
And he, Pale's first entrance is a string of expletives and racist language. And on preview night, apparently they invited like a Baptist church group.
Oh, no.
And the stage was set so that the only way out, the audience had to cross the entire stage. And he was in the middle of this harangue, expletive, expletive this, blah, 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 blah. And that entire audience bank got up and started walking through the stage. And he, just as he turned around, and then he said some unkind things as they all left.
Oh, no.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a very
and on that note, just
live
want to remind
theater, live theater.
Just want to remind everybody out there, you are listening to Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theater here on WCOM 103.5 FM. I'm in the studio with Audrey Layden, my co-host, as well as David Henderson, who's going on about all this stuff. And we're going to continue. I just wanted to let you know what this was.
In case you tuned in and wondered.
Exactly. In case you're ready to walk out. There you go.
Well, I'll let you know what you're walking out on.
Yeah.
So what other shows, what have I missed as far
as? I'm trying to think.
We've gone as far as Shakespeare, and I'm sure you did something before that.
Actually, right after Shakespeare, we pretty much started Christmas Carol.
That's right. Okay.
Christmas Carol had started in earnest in the fall. My wife is an actor as well, so she stays fairly busy.
And tell us about her performance. You said she did the Fitzgerald.
A couple of years ago at the Theater for the American South, she did a one-woman show called The Last Flapper.
And I would love to have her on the show to talk about that because
it was a great experience for her. She was wonderful in the show. And it's about Zelda Fitzgerald and her time in
a woman's monologue.
A lot. And the research she did for that piece was amazing. She just finished directing. She teaches at a community college. She just finished directing her students in The Importance of Being Earnest. That closed this weekend. So it was a big juggle of family and theater over the last weekend while I was in Durham and she was in Henderson, North Carolina. And then she will be doing Distracted with Raleigh Ensemble Players, which is a show about ADD, a family dealing with a child that may
I've
or
actually
may
heard
not
about
be
that before
ADD.
You mentioned it, yeah.
And it's a really good piece. And Raleigh Ensemble Players, really great theater down on Fayetteville Street in Raleigh, and they do great work as well. And you and I had this discussion before we started.
Yeah, we did.
About the idea that we are blessed to live where we live because there's so much great theater going on, and it's all within a drivable distance from wherever you are. I mean, I live in Raleigh. 25 minutes from my house is Man Bites Dog Theater, which is wonderful, and Little Green Pig. Mm-hmm. You know, I can come over to Chapel Hill. I can see Deep Dish. I can be in Raleigh with Burning Coal, Raleigh Ensemble Players, Theater in the Park. There's so much going on around this area.
Very true.
That artists live here as opposed to feel like they need to move away to New York or to L.A., Chicago, or whatever, to tell their stories. They're able to do it here, and that's a real gift.
I just hope we don't turn this into the next L.A. or place like that.
I hope
I
not either, trust me.
I kind of like the fact that we still have a little bit of a quaint feel.
Well, and I think we always will. I think, you know, those of us who choose to live here for a specific reason.
We just go further into the woods when they encroach.
Yeah, I don't think we'll ever get to that point. I think we are a regional center for theater. Mm-hmm. I think that there
we can quickly
become that way. I mean, you've got Playmakers here. You've got Triad Stage in Greensboro.
The one thing that gets me about a lot of the larger companies staging productions, putting on productions, they seem to draw their talent from D.C. and New York and California, places like that. You've got incredible talent right here. You really need to mine where you are.
Yeah, and I think that that's one of the things about growing as an area is that as more and more artists move here, more and more people know that there are artists here, and those artists are trained and have a sense of the craft and everything. They start to get used more and more and more. I mean, Broadway right now is all about celebrities bringing in an A-name star and that's okay because you got to make money. It's called show business. It's not called show art.
Right.
Let's be real honest about that. Right?
It's true, indeed.
We do have to make money. I mean, we have to make money as artists in order to do art. Theater companies will do things specifically to finance the rest of the season, and then they get to do the new work or whatever. But if you don't do something that makes money, it's harder to do the new work and get that off.
You have to eat.
Yeah, exactly. We have bills to pay, right?
And support the endeavor, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very much so. So
you
now
didn't
it's
know
now
what you're going to play it when you play Othello.
No, I'm Iago. I will be Iago.
Which
yeah.
is
a good part.
Which is a big mouthful. Yes.
Yeah. It's yes. Depending on where you read it, could be the second largest line load in Shakespeare or the third. Mm-hmm. If you're anywhere in the top five, it's frightening. You know, because Hamlet being number one,
right.
No doubt.
So yes, I'm very excited. Paul Frelick, the artistic director for Deep Dish Theater, has been a friend of mine for a long time. I really love him and respect him, and I've never been able to work with him. It's been a lot of times when there's a chance for us to work together, it's been around Christmas. And for 17 years, I've been doing Christmas Carol at the Christmas time. So this came up, and about 8 months, maybe a year ago, he asked me if I would consider doing this. And, you know, if somebody looks at a short, stocky, blonde guy and says, "Hey, would you play Iago?" You don't stop and go, "No." You go, "Yes, when, where, point me to the stage, I'll be there."
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, I was telling Claudio, I keep the text of Othello is on my bedside table. I try to read it, some of it every day, just to kind of get it in my mind and in my body.
Yeah, I know. And I tend to do that even if I'm performing with a symphony where I can read and don't necessarily have to go off. I still memorize it practically so that I know I'm doubly insured. I'm not going to mess up.
I want those words ingrained.
This is April, did you say?
May. I think we open in May. I'm not sure. I know we rehearse for 6 weeks, so end of March, April, and then we open, I think, and run most of May. So I'm very excited. Deep Dish Theater in the mall here in Chapel Hill is wonderful. Mm-hmm. They do great stuff.
I need to link through you with some of these folks and possibly have them on the speakers.
Yeah, and you mentioned Tony Lee.
Yeah.
He does a lot of directing for them, and he's actually directing a Tracy Letts play called Superior Donuts that J.K. Farrell is going
be
to
done.
Be in.
Okay,
and Tracy Letts was the one that he wrote the play where we beat the guy to death with a table leg. So let's bring it full circle.
Yeah.
I don't know that there's no beating to death of table legs in that show, but
well, Tony Lee directed me in my own show, Seafarers, for Thompson Theater.
That's right. Well, Tony does a lot with them, and I know J.K. is really excited. We had lunch recently, and he goes, "I'm going to do the show," and I'm like, "Great, that's
fantastic.
Really good to see him back on stage."
Good to know. A lot of good stuff coming up.
I hope.
I know. Anything that I'm wondering, I would imagine Alan Hall is going to have something to say about Christmas Carol or reviewing it.
I don't know.
I don't know.
It's weird. I don't want to say this to Alan, but sometimes it's hard to pay attention to those reviews.
Oh, I can imagine.
You know what I mean? It's nice when they say nice things about you. Yes. It's horrible when they say bad things about you. So you know, in our house, we kind of – the ego part of the actor goes, oh, I want to know, did they say good things? You know? And then the other part of you goes, oh, they said bad things? Well, they're obviously wrong. You know?
I don't really want to know.
And that's really more of it.
Well, at some point, on a totally different topic here, I want to put you and your wife to a challenge at some point, because I have never met anyone that can eat food any spicier than I can. And I understand that she can eat it even more spicy than you can. The last contest I had was with Otto Guthrie the Carolina Theater.
Yeah.
We hit it off backstage. I stage manage a lot of the big shows that come in. And I was told that nobody could handle anything spicier than he was. And sadly, we never got around to actually having that competition. But I could tell it was going to be a fun challenge. We were going to go hang out in his camper, in his bus afterwards. And then things just got swept away and the time didn't permit.
Well, I think she would accept any challenge.
Good. Well, at some point.
Yeah, and there's a difference.
We can do the sushi thing too.
I'm all about some sushi now. Let's,
he eats bait now.
Yeah, the Eastern North Carolina boy, you know.
Yeah,
so,
I love
how
this
far
stuff.
Ahead do you plan your acting gigs?
I'd like to be able to plan a lot farther. No, you know, it depends. It depends on what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I work with a lot of companies that I'm blessed to have that opportunity. And typically, 6 to 8 months ahead, I'll kind of know what's coming.
Mm-hmm.
And that helps my wife and I, because we do have a 3-year-old. It helps us kind of plan, okay, you do this, I'm not going to do this, or we'll balance it out so that we're not doing stuff at the same time. Now, it doesn't always work, because I directed her in Twelfth Night.
Mm-hmm.
And so when she was, I tried to arrange the rehearsal process so she didn't have to be there every night, so that we didn't have to pay a babysitter every night. And I don't want to do that to him. He loves being at the theater. He loves watching it. But at the same time, I don't want him, he has a bedtime. And theater people tend to not respect bedtimes, So, about 8 months ahead. Uh-huh. There's some things that I know may happen in 2 years.
Uh-huh.
Some stuff maybe with the Justice Theater Project, some new works that Deb, the artistic director, is working on writing. She's asked if my wife and I would be a part of some of that. And who knows? It could be a year and a half. It could be 2 years away before it's completed. But part of that process up at even now.
Right.
Yeah.
So that kind of uncertainty doesn't bother you?
No. No, it doesn't. As an actor, as
sort
an artist,
par for the course in a way.
Yeah,
something you live with.
Yeah, it is.
In the arts in general, I would imagine.
Yeah, it's feast or famine. Right. And we're blessed around here to have a feast. I mean, there is very rarely will you find a weekend in the year where there is not a show opening or running.
Mm-hmm.
Was it Twelfth Night? I believe when we opened Twelfth Night, there were 5, 6, maybe 7 shows opening on that exact same weekend, and they all run for 3 weeks. So there's always an opportunity to see something going on in this area, and that's a real great thing. Now the sad part about being an actor and being in theater is that it's harder for me to see as much theater sometimes. Because I'm either in the theater rehearsing or actually performing, so I don't get to see as much as I would like. But I'm really trying to see a lot more now. I just have to plan better,
So if there's somebody out there, a young person who's interested in getting into the theater, what kind of advice would you give them?
Well,
how do they get started? Show up at your doorstep and say, I want to get in.
I think there's a lot of opportunities to do it. I mean, there's a lot of great programs for youth in this area. I know there are in Raleigh. I'm sure there are in Durham and Chapel Hill as well. There's, we all start at some point in community theater.
Yes.
And that's a great thing.
The Arts Center here has opportunities for people.
Very much so. And then that's it. It's just get involved and do it. Go out and, either audition or show up and say, hey, what's going on, and learn, because it truly is a craft. I think acting is a craft, and we have to think of it that way. So there are certain skills that we learn and we hone over time. Mm-hmm. And getting involved is the first step, is going and saying, hey, I want to audition. I want to be a part of this production or whatever. And it doesn't even have to be on stage. There are people who want to do the technical stuff. And I think that's an area that we miss a lot in this area, is people doing the technical aspect of theater. It's just volunteer. Be around it. Because trust me, once it gets you, you're gotten. You know, you're not going to get away from it. I can tell you that much.
So you start to know the community.
You really do. And we are blessed to have a good community here.
Indeed, I will definitely say that. And I think on that note, we can wind it down. Oh, John Paul is here. Truth Quest is coming up. I see him in the lobby out there now. So anything you want to end with? Any final statement? Or give us the run for Christmas Carol one more time?
Christmas Carol opens tomorrow night in Memorial Auditorium, the Progress Energy Center for the Performing Arts.
Indeed.
Downtown. And we run the 8th through the 15th. I think their tickets are still available through Ticketmaster. And it's going to be a great year. And that's it.
And Ira David Wood III lives after the operation. I'm glad to hear that. Sending my love out to him and family. And look forward to having you folks on. Thank you for tuning us in. I want to thank you for the pleasure of your company. Also want to tout one more time the Historic Carolina Theatre of Durham, the primary sponsor of Gaudio Speakeasy and Radio Theatre. On behalf of David Henderson, Audrey Layden, and myself, yours truly, Claudio, this is The Speakeasy signing off. Until next time, cheers.